go away and quit that noise, Miss Lucy. Put that music book away. What's the use to keep on trying if you practice till you're gray? You can't start no notes a-flying like the ones that rants and rings from the kitchen to the big woods when Melinda sings. Easy enough for folks to holler looking at the lines and dots, but ain't no one can sense it, and the tune comes in spots. But for real melodious music that just strikes your heart and clings, just stand and listen with me when Melinda sings. Oh, it's sweeter than the music of an educated band, and it's dearer than the battle songs of triumph in the land. It seems holier than evening when those silent church bells ring, as I sit and calmly listen when Melinda sings. Sweet chariot when Melinda sings. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, 40 years ago tonight, you turned on KABU at 10, between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. to listen to Woman's Soul, you would have heard that song, which is Abby Lincoln doing When Melinda Sings. It was one of the theme songs of Woman's Soul, which was the first women's music program on KABU. I'm Barbara Bernstein, and I'm here with some very old friends, and we're going to be talking about the early days of KABU's women and how the women in KABU changed KABU and changed the world. So I have with me, in chronological order, Carol Mazur, who came to the station before 78, well before, and was program director from what years, Carol?
Well, I was actually hired to do development, and I didn't quite know what that was. And then there was a little to-do, as happened at KABU every once in a while, and I became program director.
And that was like in the mid-70s?
That was, I started in January of 76, probably till somewhere near the end of 77. Not real long. But then that seemed like a really long time, especially at KABU.
And especially when you're young.
Yeah.
And then next came Vicky Tempe, then now Vicky Stelfiola, who was had many roles. And what year did you come, Vicky?
I got started when the station was moving from Belmont Street to downtown, and it was literally schlepping records into the back of pickup trucks to take them downtown. And that would have been summer of 77. That's when I first got involved. That's when I met you at that point, Carol.
That's right.
So back then, that's when KABU was the size of this room. No, it was a little bit bigger.
It was twice the size of this room, I think.
Yeah.
And
two
then
rooms.
Maureen Key, who came just slightly after Vicki.
Yes, I think it was probably 78, 79, I'm thinking. I can't remember.
78, because you were here when I came
Okay, 78.
Did you and I serve on the board together?
I think we did for, yes.
That's right.
That's how we were able to get that retreat done.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get there.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, and then I'm the only one here who's like probably had the longest continuum time here in KBOO. But I started doing some of what I do today back in 78. And actually, I realized my 40th anniversary at KBOO. So I'm just like 10 years younger than the station itself, so to speak. But I actually came here in 1971. I came to Portland in the fall of 71. And I'd been here about 2 days, and there was an uprising at the prison in Attica, New York. And I was here with some other recent New Yorkers, and we had contacts with people in New York. And so we did a show about the Attica prison uprising here on KBOO. And in those days, and this is when it was two rooms the size of this room that we're in here that Vicki was describing, you could just kind of walk into the studio on Belmont Street and say, I want to do a show. And so we did, and we did this very long special about Attica. And then I actually moved to Portland officially a couple months later. And within, days, I was doing, they needed to fill in late night spots. And so I would do like all night shows with my friends. And I stayed with the station until through the summer of 72. In the summer of 72, we started the first news department. And also there was the first women's music being played on KBOO. And at the end of the summer, the news department and the women's music programs were yanked off the air. The news department was considered by the men who ran KBOO a lesbian conspiracy. I think there were two lesbians, three straight women, and five men on that. But it was definitely dangerous and subversive. And the women's music was yanked off for some bogus reason, like, oh, it was only supposed to be temporary programming. So in a huff, I left the station. It didn't come back until 78. So that's my story in a nutshell. So I want to get back to Carol, because you were at the station at some very interesting times.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. Let me first say that I came to Portland at the end of 73, and one of the first people I met was a woman called Joan Cook, and we had worked at the women's bookstore together. That's the first volunteer thing I did. And she introduced me to her best friend from high school, from growing up, and her name was Mary Catherine Lamb. And pretty soon after that, I was saying earlier, when I came, there was one woman who was very central. She was the program director, and that was Karen Burdick. And she really knew her stuff. She taught me radio. She taught me how to edit. She taught me everything technical that I needed to learn. And I think that it was a moment when, women at KBOO became like a kind of magnet, and we started all being drawn there. And that's when Susan Dobroff soon after came, Jan, whose last name I don't remember.
It'll come.
Mary Orr was hired. And all of a sudden, Asu, the volunteer coordinator.
Sergeant.
Sue Sargent. And so, I don't know, it just seemed easy at that time. And the men who were on staff at that particular moment were really nice men and really supportive. Andy Simon.
Who was the station manager back at that point?
Dick. Somebody called Dick.
Okay.
He was dark-haired. I don't remember.
Last names don't stick along.
His name was... if you had asked me that question last week, I would not have remembered, but all of a sudden I see him sitting at that desk. And when I say sitting at a desk, there were two desks, and there were about five staff. So some of the work that I did, I would go home, turn on the radio, and do my work, because there was no place to work. And I remember one day Andy Simon saying to me, hey, did you see that thing that's posted in the bathroom? And I said, no, what are you talking about? And then I realized we only had one little bathroom, right? I realized that I didn't stand up looking at the wall when I went to the bathroom. I was looking the other way. And of course I didn't see what was on the wall behind
Well, I think that sums up, in a way, though, some of the challenges that women felt at KBOO, especially the first, I mean, when I came here, KBOO was already 3 years old, but so old, but it had a long ways to go, I think, in terms of, like, understanding that women have as much of a right to express themselves as men do, and that there was a lot of discomfort about strong women. And it seems like by the time you came, there was less discomfort. But I still think, even when I was involved with the station in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a whole lot of sexism. And one of the things that when Vicky, I think you were station manager at this point, we started talking about parody. It was the parody of voices on the air. And there were two concerns. One was equal number of women. I think we were trying to get it up to like 30% women. And we also wanted to have African-American voices on. And I think we got it up to about 20%. So there was still, I mean, KBOO was for a very long time a bastion of white men.
Yes.
And it was a sort of a countercultural environment that eschewed anything that struck, it smelled of structure, organization. And so that brings in Maureen, who, by the way, I want to say a little thing about Maureen.
Okay.
She'll explain her background, but I got an email from Maureen yesterday saying, I'm really looking forward to seeing you all. Do you have any idea what we're going to talk about? Maybe we should have a meeting before. So that, to me, sums up Maureen.
Yes, I was all about structure and organizational development when I came here. And I only served as a board director. I was never on air, except maybe to pitch for fundraising and to answer phones or so. But mostly I was here to provide a little bit of structure. Not that it was necessary. So it was quite the deal, providing structure in basically what I saw as an anarchy and all the incredible diversity of thinking. Maybe not so much diversity in other ways, but certainly in thought, there was a lot of diversity, which is what attracted me. Very different than working in a large Fortune 500 company.
Which is what you were doing?
That's what I was doing. Yeah, I was working at Tektronix, a relatively good company at the time, and was a manufacturing manager, a human resources manager, different jobs at different times, but mostly I was interested in organizational development, and I now have a master's in organizational development.
I was thinking about a friend of mine who was a station manager of the station in Olympia called Chaos, and he loved to say that he was the manager of Chaos. Yeah. And I was driving back from Tacoma the day listening to Chaos as long as I could listen to it, and it's still pretty chaotic. It was kind of, it's a college station, but I was thinking how that could be KBOO's surname, is Chaos. Yeah. But somehow it's been managed chaos for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted you to talk, Maureen, about what you did to help manage the chaos of KBOO.
Oh, boy. Well, one thing I have to say right up front is that I couldn't have helped if it hadn't been for certain other people who saw that maybe a little structure would be helpful, like Vicky Stabiello and Michael Wells and a few others. I'd say one of the things that I did that I thought really was effective was to talk the board into having a retreat. It's like a 2.5-day retreat. We went to the beach. Very hard. People looked at that with a lot of suspicion.
Why are they suspicious?
Well, it could have been me. I was a corporate person. Or it could be that we would be making decisions away from the larger community, and people were a little suspicious of that, I think.
Did the staff come to the retreat, or was it
no.
just a board retreat?
No,
and
just the board.
And even the station manager wasn't there?
Wasn't the station
Michael
manager
was
there?
Michael was the manager then.
Yeah, the station manager was there, and we hired a facilitator, mm-hmm. even, who, by the way, I remember after the first day of meetings, we're all drinking and having a good time. The facilitator's lying on the couch, dead asleep. She was
exhausted.
We exhausted her, that poor woman. So I think that we got a lot done. I have to thank Vicky, if it weren't for her credibility and sort of talking it up, it probably wouldn't have happened. But one of the things that we did there was state a purpose for the station.
Mm-hmm. Which they became like a mission.
A mission statement
was written at that first retreat.
At that first retreat.
And what was that mission statement? Do you have it in front of you on your phone
here? Well, I don't have it in front of me, but there is a part of it left in your current mission statement, which is to provide underserved communities in our town radio waves. Mm-hmm. And
an alternative to what the also, mainstream media provides. And then you brought in the element of, and we will do this in an excellent way.
Well, yes.
You did that.
We wanted excellence in organization as well.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking that you, you're talking now about 1978 pretty much.
Yes.
Now, the station was 10 years old. And I just wonder, like, how does anybody have any idea how it survived for those first 10 years without any kind of organization or structure?
Well, see, you don't really need it.
What do you think, Carol?
Well, there was not no structure. Right. There was just not real structure. And I think it was incumbent upon the staff at that time to try to organize things as best we could. And, you know, looking back, you know, KBOO, knock on wood, is the oldest, apart from the Pacifica station, is the oldest community radio station that's continuously been operated in this country. And, you know, I still, as an ex-program director, turn on the radio, listen to it, and go, oh, my God, why aren't they saying this? Or, you know, they're not pronouncing this correct. Why doesn't somebody tell them how to pronounce Fallujah? Or, but, you know, when you look at that history, and there were growing pains every several years. Yep. And I recall there was a really difficult one in 1976 when I don't remember what the issues were, but I know it was the board pitted against the staff. And I remember playing a lot of Malvina Reynolds songs at that time. They got the world in their pocket, but their pocket's got a hole. This is the way we thought of the board at that particular
time. So it was sort of a challenge between, I mean, like seeing that they're opposing forces as opposed to being unified forces.
And it's interesting because we were not really opposing in terms of our world outlook and really what we thought the station needed, but it was... There was I don't know if it was a power thing or it was real. We were really trying to birth the next epoch of the station. I think that's mainly what it was. I remember Phoebe Friedman.
Oh, yeah.
Norman Solomon was on the board.
Oh, yeah. You served with Norman.
Yeah.
Norman Solomon didn't want to pay you, though, as I recall.
That's correct. And I had a big problem with him for many years.
Actually, I want to take a little music break because, after all, this is Women's Show here on KBOO, and it's Friday night, and it's really a little earlier than we would have done Women's Soul. But I pulled out a whole bunch of albums tonight, you know, LPs, and I really felt like I was going off to do a show in the late 70s, early 80s. It was a great feeling. So we're going to, I don't know, I just kind of left it up to Aaron Yankee, who's our engineer, to kind of pick the next tune. So, Aaron, are you ready to spin some music? Okay, this is Laurie Anderson doing X Equals X.
I met this guy, and he looked like he might have been a hat check clerk at an ice rink, which in fact, he turned out to be. And I said, oh boy, right again. Could be you. It's a sky blue sky. Satellites are out tonight. Let X equal X. You know? I could write a book, and this book would be thick enough to stun an ox. 'Cause I can see the future, and it's a place about 70 miles east of here, where it's lighter. Linger on over here. Got the time. Let X equal X. Just like a woman, she said, it's hard. It's just hard. It's just kind of hard to say. He said, isn't it just like a woman? She said it to know. She said it to no one. Day's work to look into them.
looking into them.
As I'm listening to Laurie Anderson, I'm remembering the production room on the Yamhill, in the Yamhill Street Station, which was a room about half the size of what we're sitting in, full of these kind of okay, little funky old tape recorders. And I remember sitting on the floor of the production room recording a concert that was being broadcast from New Music America in San Francisco, and it was over the public radio satellite system. It was before the satellite system, actually, so it was a phone line, and we'd plug our board into it, and then I was just recording this, and I was listening to Laurie Anderson. I think it was the first time I heard her do Oh Superman, and it was a very exciting moment, and I felt like I was in San Francisco as I sat in the Kibu production room, and then we aired it, and we did a whole series. Actually, Richard Francis and I did a whole series about New Music America. So that's my Laurie Anderson story. Yeah. But I was feeling kind of nostalgic about that production room because it was where I really learned how to cut tape and really learned a lot more skills than my other brief stint in radio when I was living in San Francisco in 71. And I was thinking, Carol, about you talking about how Karen Burdick taught you everything you know. And my first question is, how did Karen Burdick learn that stuff?
Well, you know, I don't remember. But she was there as the program director. So it was post Bill Reinhart. Karen had gone to Reed, and at some point in time, a whole bunch of Reed people dropped out together with some of the teachers, and they lived in house together. And that's what I remember about Karen's, where Karen came from, how she got there. It happened before me, but. Karen was a very soft-spoken kind of person, but when she had something to say, you knew it. And I think when I got there, it was like a chance for her to really, you know, have a buddy. You know, we really became a duo there.
Were there very many other women at KBOO at that time?
No, on the staff at that point, it was just Karen and I.
She was actually from Reno.
No, and Sue. Sue Sargent. And yes. Sue Sargent.
Right. Yes. But she was from Reno, Nevada. I remember that.
She was from Aurora, California.
Oh, okay.
Which is close by. I don't know if you told her about this, but Karen, I hope you're listening. She lives in New York now.
She's lived in New York for a really long time.
Really, since 1978.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I remember I met Karen at the Weezer Fiddle Festival in 1974, and she was toting around a portable reel-to-reel tape recorder. And she was doing interviews with all the different musicians. And she had a little KBOO badge. And I was very curious because I still had my anger towards KBOO from the male chauvinism days. And it was amazing to see this woman representing KBOO, a woman. And she was obviously very techie. So that gave me a sense that KBOO was starting to transform itself.
She stayed techie because when she went to New York, she got a job at WNYC fixing tape recorders.
It's been a long time since I've seen Karen, too.
Yeah.
So I want to get, you mentioned a little bit, Vicki, about the move from Belmont Street, which, just to let people know, you can go, this is a historic building. You can go to it. It's like between 31st and 32nd on Belmont Street. It's on the north side of the street. It's this funky storefront. And above it, well, there used to be a double-decker house, but I think it burnt down a number of years ago. Actually, some KBOO volunteers that used to live in that house when I came here in 71. But it, and Per Fargering, KBOO luminary, had the Phantom Gallery in the same space for a number of years. But it was a very, it was just this very funky building. And I'm curious about the move and how KBOO was transformed when we moved from Belmont Street to Yamhill Street downtown.
Well, in a historical context, every time KBOO moves, there's been an expansion of the human population. So that when we went from Belmont downtown, lots more people could be accommodated and could do work in the station because there was no room to do work.
How would you describe the difference between the two studios?
I think Yamhill Street was probably, let's see, this is 5,000 square feet. I think Yamhill was about 2,000 square feet, maybe.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
That's all.
And Belmont was like 500 square feet, maybe. 200 square feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, It was really, really small, and it was very chaotic. There were, you know, the physical plant. Mm-hmm. You know, there was like paper everywhere and files everywhere.
Soundproofing in the studio, as I recall, because there was a room that where all the tape mm-hmm. recorders were. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you broadcast. That's where I think the engineer was and the announcer. And then there's this other room, which was the studio. And I remember back in 71, I was there, and they were nailing egg cartons to yep. the walls to soundproof yep. it, which now, doesn't work.
Now, I don't really have a lot of history. I think Carol does more on the Belmont Street studio. I got there just literally months before moving out into Yamhill Street. So the Yamhill Street, you know, there was a big studio like here. There were a couple production rooms. There was a big foyer when you walked in. There were some small offices in the back. I don't think we had any doors that closed, which was a real, in Yamhill Street, which is kind of a problem. You know, a staff person would leave a pencil on their desk and the next morning it would be gone. You know, you couldn't leave anything anywhere because some volunteer would come in and pilfer it and take it to some other little cubicle. So it was a step up in terms of space, but there were a lot of things that had not been taken into account.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that I think about. One was space, because, mm-hmm. I mean, it was very pretty. It had this bare brick wall, mm-hmm. and it was in a historic building. It was on Yamhill Street, one door up from Front Avenue, now NATO Parkway. Mm-hmm. It was above this bar.
Well, the bar came in later.
Right.
Cabo was brought in to
gentrify.
The first step of gentrifying the neighborhood by bringing people into the neighborhood.
Hey, look, we gentrified this neighborhood too.
Yes, we did. Yes, yeah. We did. You bring more humans in, that's what happens.
But we're back to a basement here.
Right. Yeah.
So the Fern Bar came in later, and the attorneys upstairs came in later.
And the architects.
And it was the design team from Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill, I think, was up on the top floor. I'm going to tell a story about that space, though, because once the landlord said that he did not want to renew our lease, and we got on this crash course to figure out where we're going to go and so on. I don't know. Once we had gotten pretty much underway over here, I decided to stop in. I was downtown. I thought I would stop in and see what was happening. And the landlord had hired a family member, an extended family member, to dismantle Cabo from the second floor of that building. I went in. The guy was absolutely heartsick because he was a builder, not a destroyer. He said, I'll never do this again. I'll never take on a job where I've been hired to destroy something that has been built. And unfortunately, in that process with a sawzall, he cut the water lines by accident. He was in, you know, taking out the studs, and it flooded the Fern Bar. The ceiling collapsed down. The Fern Bar, of course, sued the landlord. And
this is after Cabo had moved here.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Our lemon became a lemonade. And it was a real turning. I was alone in the space with this guy, and he was heartsick about what had happened, not just in terms of his accident, but he said, this is not for me. Taking things apart. And by the way, Cabo Studios there were glued and screwed. And if you know anybody in construction, glued and screwed is not easy to take apart. I mean, you literally have to get a sawzall, which will cut through anything.
Including water mains and water pipes.
Yes, including water mains. Well, so quite the karmic turnaround.
Can I just go back
sure.
a minute?
Yeah.
You know, I was around and I recall the move. And I was always very skeptical because I thought, how is Cabo going to find the money to pay this rent year after year after year? And I, you know, I enjoyed being on the air there. We had a beautiful view from the studio looking out. Mm-hmm. It was a great place to interview people. And at that point, I was doing a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me, and perhaps maybe I channeled what Portland has become, where the rents have gotten so ridiculous. So, you know, I think many of us were against, not against a move, but against a move to downtown, that it made no sense for a community radio station at that point.
And I was ignorant of that decision, but the station went into such severe debt building those studios on Yamhill Street, there was a lien against the station from Carr Lumber because we hadn't paid our bill. And no landlord likes to have a tenant get a lien against their structure. So that was part of the energy of getting us out of there, that we were unreliable.
Well, the other part, as I recall, there was also going to be a balloon payment. Not a balloon payment, but our rent was going to get jacked up after 5 years. That this station manager, who's the one who negotiated the move, who we're not going to mention, we're not going to honor him by even mentioning his name or saying anything else about him, but he signed a lease for 5 years, and that seemed to be very short-sighted. And so that's one of the ways I think the landlord got us out was, I remember, because I was on staff at that point, it jacked up the rent, a huge amount, which you could do because the lease was over.
Okay, so when I got hired, Michael Wells, who had been the manager, said, okay, let's go over and show the flag and meet, you know, you'll meet the landlord and so on. Our first meeting, he says, well, your lease is up in 6 months. No, a year and a half. It was a year and a half out. He said, and at that point, I will not renew the lease. I will extend the lease at twice the rent. So it gave us a year and a half to find a building, finance it, design it, build it, pay for it, and move in.
Another thing about that building, as much as, I mean, when I first came, and this is when I came back to KBOO, was in 78, and it was kind of in the middle of the period it was still early in the period, being on Yamhill Street. But I thought it was a beautiful building, and it was historic, and everything, I thought that the studios seemed kind of spiffy compared to where I was living at any rate. But I started appreciating, and when I was on staff for about 2.5 years, and you could just, the building was, the studio was not large enough for the staff that we had. And at that point, our staff was swollen by CETA employees, and we even had a paid record librarian, music director, and all kinds of things that we haven't been able to afford since. And looking at the way that the station was designed, it really was designed without any room for growth. And I think that those are the two things that, Vicki, that you had in mind when you started looking at spaces was, first of all, is it affordable? Well, there was three. One, third one, you were actually looking to buy as opposed to rent. And I also thought you were thinking in terms of having it be a little bit elastic.
Don't attribute all those good thoughts to me, because I think what we really had, and Maureen was a big part of this, we had a capital campaign committee that didn't just look at how are we going to pay for this. They looked at what is it that we truly need, and then how are we going to pay for it. And Maureen is a visionary thinker. She would say, "More, yes, you were."
She just made
this little face.
She looks humble.
She would say, "You have to envision where you want to be. If you can't imagine it, then you'll never get there. So you have to think about where you want to be, and then you back up from that to like, okay, here's where I am now. How will we move toward that?" And so the committee, which had some staff people, some board members, and some volunteers, was looking at what are our overall needs. And we came up with some real simple criteria. Let us not be on a max line so that the building shakes every 45 minutes.
That was another good reason we left, because the max was just being built.
And I think it
became operational a few months after we opened the station.
A masonry building, because they are more stable than a wood building in terms of vibrations, because everything was on turntables then. And the third thing was centrally located, because we had people coming from all over the Portland metropolitan area. And one of the buildings we looked at became the Firehouse Theater up in North Portland.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great building. Yeah. But it's
And George Page said, "Don't go there." Mm-hmm. And we said, "What?" He said, "If you locate the station in the black community, a lot of your people will drop off. They won't be willing to go onto Union, into the Albina." Now, of course, that's all changed now.
That's for sure.
But the other part of it is, for somebody who lives in Selwood, that is really far from anybody who lives in Southeast Portland.
Yes.
So, I mean, KBOO, I think that the location we have now is just as good as downtown in terms of centrality.
Oh, yeah. Better.
It's actually better. Actually, there used to be better parking. It's starting to rival in the Yamhill days. But it's it's on bus lines. It just seems like it's very well placed in terms of being accessible.
Yes.
And there's something about it. Well, when we moved here, I think we were surrounded by a a whorehouse, actually, and a drug house, and it was a really interesting neighborhood. So it was kind of a DMZ. This was like nobody's neighborhood. Nobody owned it except for the pimps
whoever,
and the prostitutes.
Whoever was living here and doing business here,
right.
However they were.
They went away, and now we have the Jupiter Hotel, which is much, much nicer neighbors.
I'm going to give a small shout-out to my former husband, who was a KBOO volunteer, and he was working half-time. And he said, okay, I'll meet with all these, I'll go and talk to all these commercial real estate people, and I've got your criteria, and when I identify buildings, and we'd all go and look. We would look at the build, you know, we went to the Firehouse Theater, we looked at, I don't know how many structures, I don't remember, and this was one of them that fit those criteria. The public transportation, centrally located, you know.
The only thing I'll say about it is really ugly. I mean, when we moved in here, it was just this. I used to live in this neighborhood about 12 years. It was 11 years before KBOO moved here. And I lived just about two blocks away. And it's just, in that point, it was a time when they were tearing down all the houses on my block on 9th between Ankeny and Ash and putting up these warehouses and businesses that were all cinder block. And this is when this building went in.
And 40s, actually.
Well, this one's older, but there were a lot of other buildings that kind of aped this one. Mm-hmm. And so it was basically looked like a big garage. And it had no character, unlike the beautiful historic building we were in on Yamhill Street. Mm-hmm. And I felt some sadness about it. But the other part of it was just a empty palette.
Right.
Or empty canvas. And it just took, and your current husband was responsible for shaping.
Some of it.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'm pulling a blank. You know, this is what happens you get to be over 70. The actual schematic design for this radio station was done by Howard Glazer, who was quite the iconic architect in Portland and also did a lot of work in Cuba, definitely a leftist, and gave all of his time, all of his services to do the design work, you know, worked with the board of directors, worked with intensely with the engineering staff. You know, a lot of people wanted to put the air room right out front, and he said, oh, no, you're not. Humans belong out front. You have very little natural light in this building, and we don't want people to be having to work in a cave. So anyway, Howard, rest in peace, wonderful person, you know, did all the schematic design. So the layout you're seeing is a result of his genius, I guess, and his listening. I mean, he was a really good architect as far as listening to people and finding out what the needs were.
Well, it developed, as I remember, as there were two cores, and there was the office core, which is what is up front where the people work, and then there was the on-air, the radio, the production core, which includes, at that time, there were two production rooms, I mean, two studios and two production rooms, and now there's more, because that's the thing about this place. Even though it seemed like we were kind of built out 10 years ago, we seem to keep finding these nooks and crannies to build. Like, we have a really wonderful digital studio now that used to be a room. It was a satellite room, right. We don't use the satellite anymore. So, I mean, it has this ability to really grow and develop. And that was one thing we didn't have at Yamhill Street. There was no place to grow.
There was a hope at the time that this building was acquired that we could put a second floor on. And what's happened is the seismic code has changed, and so now we could still do it. How much money you got? You know, it's not impossible.
But the seismically is an issue.
You have to stiffen the building in a variety of ways, and it would be a very invasive process to do that. But not going into that technical detail. But that's what we really hope for. There were dreams of a south-facing patio on the second floor, and maybe even a hot tub,
sort of like the Woodstock New Seasons and a bar. Now I want to get back to fundraising, Maureen, because you had a strong influence, I think, also in our taking ourselves seriously in terms of fundraising. I had this little memory of we were going to, this is when I was on the board with you. You were the board president, and I was the board hippie. And we were going to go meet with some rich people to ask for some money. And this was the first time I'd ever done anything like that. And I guess I put on my best jeans, my best flannel shirt, and I was concerned, and I said to you, well, they're going to look at me and just think I'm a hippie. She said, no, they're going to think you're an eccentric rich person.
Did we get money from them?
I don't remember.
But do you remember back then, everybody wore flannel shirts?
Right. Well, even
rich people wore Pendletons.
I wore silk shirts. I'm sorry.
Actually, I made my own flannel shirt, so they were designer shirts.
And then she made us bathrobes. She made me and five children bathrobes. Me and Michael and...
Right, yeah.
Maya and Melissa and Michael, then ended Mark,
my
and
career, then ended my career as sewing for money. After it was terry cloth bathrobes, and I had brown lung when it was finished.
I bet you did.
So I'm curious to talk a little bit more, though, about how KBOO started taking it seriously to raise money. Because we had to have a capital campaign, didn't we, to buy mm-hmm. this building and everything?
Yep.
Were you still involved at that point, Maureen?
Oh, yeah, she was.
Yes, I was. The first thing we had to do is to raise money to hire a guy to run the capital campaign, which was Miles Gannon.
That sounds right.
Yeah. So we had to get the money to hire him, at which point I contributed a lot, probably the most I'd ever contributed to a nonprofit. I felt very grown up, actually, doing that. And then we got some community leaders. We had this breakfast thing that we invited people like Bing Sheldon to, mm-hmm. and told them what was going on, how could they help us raise money, et cetera. And I think we got some help that way, for mm-hmm. sure. Other than that, I honestly can't remember too much about raising money. It wasn't my strong suit, I didn't think.
Well, one thing is, an anonymous donor, who's been a longtime KBOO supporter, sold some stock and gave us the proceeds. I think it was about $12,000. That was our initial wad of dough. And I won't mention her name on the air, just because she did ask to be anonymous originally, and I think rumor has spread. But
well, I'll be hitting her up, so it's a good idea.
Yeah, and then we did, you know, eventually we got a grant from the, the Oregon Arts Commission. I think we got money from McKenzie River Gathering. There were some hunks of money that nowadays sounds like nothing. We built this station on less than $100,000 cash. All the rest was volunteers or donations of materials, or probably mm-hmm. standing on floor that was donated.
Well, actually, there was a while, and this is fortunately no longer the case, it felt like this place, the flooring came from a showroom.
It did.
And so every floor, every room had a different floor pattern, and
right.
sometimes one room might have five or six different floor patterns.
What it was is a lumber flooring company, wood flooring company, gave us all the flooring. And then it just had to be figured out, like, okay, we've got 400 square feet of this and 200 square feet of that. Which room would it fill? So I remember asking Howard how much this would have cost if we had just paid it out of pocket. And he said about $250,000. And I don't know what this would cost now to build. I have no idea. But it was for about $100,000 cash. So somebody giving $3,000 or $12,000 was a substantial contribution.
Well, it's also in those days, property values were a lot lower
different
in Portland
yeah.
than they are. Because
yeah.
this really was an area like nobody in mm-hmm. their right mind would think about mm-hmm. coming to. And Burnside, well, there were no restaurants in Burnside at that point.
Well, there were basically no restaurants right. in Portland at that
Skid
point.
Row.
Well, yes, there were actually at yeah. that point. But there were some very good. Bijou was already
we're
around.
We're in the 80s.
Yeah, right.
Sorry.
80, yeah. yeah, there were some good
I
restaurants.
I haven't moved up from the 70s.
Right.
Yet.
Yeah. You were still in Spain. So,
yeah. yeah.
So there was, I mean, this neighborhood was, and that was, I think, an advantage, that this neighborhood was not exactly
desirable.
A desirable neighborhood. Yeah. And so it was something that we could afford. And it's interesting that when Imago Theater moved mm-hmm. across the street from us, and that's probably 20 years now, mm-hmm. that suddenly there was like this energy lift. It was kind mm-hmm. of the synergy between two arts organizations, or whatever you want to call us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what shifted, and that's what really started the gentrification mm-hmm. of this neighborhood.
I think the other thing to mention, though, is that there were people who could give $500, okay? So I could give $500. But there were so many tiny contributions, 50, 100, 25. And the people who were on the air were the ones who made the difference with that. And again, kudos to George Page. He would mm-hmm. pitch all the time, back what you believe in. Mm-hmm. And when people complained that we had a porta potty, he said, hey, we've got a porta potty out back, and we want to have a regular bathroom inside the structure, and we need you to give the money for it. And we're tired of having tricks being turned in our porta potty. which was literally happening.
Actually, we actually had the offices were across the street in this kind of flophouse or office complex. It's like two-story, looked like a motel. And that's where all the business was going on. Well, we finished the radio part first.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was interesting to be doing radio while they're hammering in the front core of the building.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to say that I think at that point, the late 70s, early 80s was when all kinds of nonprofit organizations started realizing they needed to shape up a little bit. And also that the board was there to help raise money.
Yep, they did.
And that wasn't true earlier. You know, when I was hired as development director, it wasn't really clear what kind of development that was. I thought in terms of programming. And I also thought in terms of, you know, helping more people come into the radio station. And George Page was also a great ally of mine. You know, I just heard Lynn Darroch on the other radio station that we didn't have in the old days because we had jazz here, but now we have a whole radio station.
Right.
He did a really beautiful piece a couple weeks ago about George. I think George was a person who helped this place grow in so many ways,
yep.
and mainly by bringing in all kinds of people right. from the community.
He was a real bridge builder.
He was utterly a bridge builder.
Yeah.
You know, he lives in this building, I would say. You
Isn't
know,
that the George Page Memorial Air Booth?
Then? Yes, yep. I know that.
So I want to take another musical break.
Okay.
And this time we're going to listen to some Sweet Honey in the Rock, and this is good. Breaths, and this is another woman's soul favorite.
Okay.
Listen more often to things than to things. Listen more often to things than to things. 'Tis the ancestor's bird when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's bird in the voice of the water. Those who have died have never left. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. They are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth. So listen more often to things than to things. Listen more often to things than to things. 'Tis the ancestor's breath when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's breath in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never left. The dead have a pact with the living. They are in the woman's breast. They are in the wailing child. They are with us in the home. They are with us in the crowd. The dead have a pact with the So listen more often to things than to things. Listen more often to things than to things. 'Tis the ancestor's word when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's word in the voice of the water. Listen more often.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock. And you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. And this is the Women's Look Back 2 hours. And I'm here with Carol Mazur, who was program director back in the mid-70s, Maureen Key, who was the board president in the late 70s, early 80s, and Vicki Stoppiello, who's just coming in the door, who was station manager back in the late 70s, early 80s, and has actually had one or two more stints as station manager since then. And Vicki and I probably have the most continual relationship with KBOO, and I'm Barbara Bernstein. And I do Locus Focus these days, but I've had a checkered career at KBOO. I was on staff. I've been a volunteer music programmer, public affairs programmer, board member, program director. I've gotten a lot of hate mail and found myself bashed on indie media many years ago for being too liberal. So anyway, that's my career at KBOO.
Really?
Yes.
You were too liberal.
I was too liberal. So I wanted to get back to Maureen, because while we were listening to Sweet Honey, she was talking about the need for personnel policy. And actually, Maureen, you brought the whole concept of a personnel policy to KBOO, as well as the idea of board retreats. So
yes.
What is a personnel policy?
Well, you know, just in case you want to hire and fire people and do it in a legal way, it's pretty important to have a process that everybody agrees to. And just in case somebody wants to complain about how they're treated, it's important to have a process for that too, a review process. So we were getting big. We had a staff of maybe 7, I think, and there were probably 300 volunteers and people coming and going. And at that point, it just seemed the time to put some of these things in place. How do you pay people? How do you give performance reviews? All that kind of stuff.
Performance reviews.
I'm sorry, I even said it.
That took a really long time, as I recall, to get those instituted. Were you still around when they actually started doing those?
I hope so. I think I remember giving performance reviews to the station manager.
Mm-hmm. And the manager giving performance reviews to staff, which usually there was a lot of input from other people. You know, anyone in the station could give input through a written process.
Yeah. I think it's still that way. Though actually, I don't remember seeing the forms. They used to be out on the bulletin board in the front lobby, but and it's kind of interesting because my sense is by the point where the performance reviews were like really carved in stone, I was a volunteer again, and I wasn't. Well, I think I was on the board for part of that time too, but I would find that I was really only motivated to do a performance review when somebody really, really made me angry and I really wanted them to go. And I think that that's a real problem. And that, to me, is part of the problem of the culture at KBOO, because people only got feedback when they did something that made people angry. And people very rarely got feedback when they did something that people really liked. It's sort of taken for granted that people will like what you do, but if you cross any lines, forget it.
It's true out in the bigger world, because I've served as a city councilor in a small town, same thing. People like what you're doing, they never show up at the meetings. If they don't like what you're doing or a decision that the council's made, guess what? They're there with their knives out. And that's an unfortunate part of our culture, I think, that we don't give enough support, emotional support, for people who take on leadership roles in general.
Especially in an organization where they're all the volunteers, you really need an acknowledgement culture. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we ever did anything specific to make that happen, like little, you know, pats on the back that you would hand out or something.
A period there have been volunteer appreciation parties that KBOO's organized. I'm not sure how well they're attended, because I've never gone to any, I have to admit. But there, I started feeling this change across the nonprofit culture in the last couple of years. Because I'm getting it a lot from other community groups that I work with, kind of collaborative way, that people are always thanking me for the work that I do, and they're always thanking everybody else for the work that they do. And I hear that at KBOO now, and it's in part of the emails that we all get from staff. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so important, because even when I started realizing that it's not just me who's getting thanked, you know, everybody is like, well, I'm glad everybody's getting thanked, because a lot of people are doing really good work.
Monica Beamer, who I don't know if you've met Monica. Have you, Maureen, met Monica?
I haven't.
She was a manager until, what, about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
She came from Sisters of the Road, had a really strong management background, mm-hmm. does consulting work all over the country about their particular way of working with people. Mm-hmm. And Monica really wanted to do a shift toward a more positive approach to the interpersonal relationships. And I think she changed the tone. One longtime person at the station went to some sessions that Monica had organized and said, wow, what a change in atmosphere. And
well, the Hope Beloved Community
yes.
Project.
Yes.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the work that Monica did. And the other thing that she did, though, which was hard for certain longtime guys at the station, was that she was really challenging sexism at the mm-hmm. station, and also sexual harassment, which mm-hmm. I think a lot of people kind of didn't want to look at. And there are, you know, some great KABU stalwarts, you know, some of the great stars of KABU who also had, you know, terrible attitudes and actions towards women. And I think that Monica set a tone where it's not permissible anymore to do mm-hmm. that. And it's been hard for the guys. I think that there's a lot of guys that I'm hoping they're starting to look at the behavior and realize there's a reason why they're called on it, that it's not okay. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in this whole Me Too movement that we're in now, it's just a glimpse of just how much more work we have to do to really get through to it. And I think a lot of people will say, oh, that wouldn't happen at KABU. KABU is just so progressive and so groovy. And
yeah,
so,
it happens everywhere.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, there was also this non-questioning attitude in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s that men did this and women did this. And no matter how much roles changed, men still did this and women still did this. And really, it's only very recently that these things are being brought out. And I think a lot of men just don't quite get it. You know, they don't quite get what kind of behavior is not appropriate. I'm just trying to be friendly.
No, right, yeah.
And it takes a certain amount of courage to confront that, no matter who you are. In other words, one of our notorious board members, when I served as station manager again in the October of 2013 until June of 2014, when Monica and Mike got hired as co-managers. And one of the ways I would cool my jets emotionally was I'd go for a walk. And one day I was putting on my raincoat and I was ready to go out, and a board member was coming in, a man about my age, and he said, what are you up to? I said, oh, I'm going for a walk. I got to go run off some steam. And so he and I started walking occasionally, maybe once every 10 days, 2 weeks. Notorious guy for making comments about women. Very, you know, a guy who's always had an eye out, let's put it that way. And I just used to blow him off and say, you know, cut it out, you know. We're in a relationship here, just don't do that, you know. And that's one of the things that's also our responsibility, is to call people on their behavior, you know. And very often, if you've been feeling kind of held down, or you're not being nice, aren't we supposed to be nice? Be authentic. However you can, you know, because I think that person has gotten some reprimands within the organization. And I would go and sit next to him in a board meeting, and he'd do stuff, and I was just going to elbow him in the ribs and say, cut it out. And I'm sure people are thinking, what's the staff member doing elbowing a board member? But I think that's also our responsibility as women, to be strong and to speak our truth. And that's such a cute phrase, isn't it? Speak our truth. It's not easy sometimes. It's difficult. There's feelings inside your gut that might mitigate against that.
Well, when I came to KABU,
first of all, you have to know your truth.
This is true.
And sometimes that's pretty difficult. Yeah. And then there's the other side of it, like you said, you want to be nice, you don't want to be disliked, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, when I came to KABU in 78, or came back, women were really in a ghetto, because there were basically three women's programs, and then there were a handful of women programmers who did music shows. And then we had actually a public affairs director who was a woman, but she wasn't really doing public affairs at that point. And things started to change as there were more and more women, I think, who started coming on staff. And I was just thinking tonight, the only women's show that was on the air in 1978 that's still on is Bread and Roses, which has transformed a lot. And I think it's changed with the times. But there's really probably no need for Woman's Soul to be on anymore. It did get moved, I think, to a weird time on Sunday night sometime about 20 years ago, and then it was gone. But there's a lot of women programmers, and there's a lot of women's music on the show, mm-hmm. on the station, and I'm really glad that it doesn't have to have a ghetto to exist in. Mm-hmm. But I think back in the late 70s, early 80s, that women, not just the Kiwi, in a lot of places, only felt safe to really express themselves in women's spaces. I wonder how that felt to you, all of you, in those times.
You know, I was just going to say that was also true of women's bookstores. You know, there was a little collective down on Grand Avenue, and it was a space to get books that you really couldn't get elsewhere. I mean, Powell's hadn't become the Powell's we know now. And then a few years later, I think in the 80s, the Catbird Seat.
Oh, yeah.
Was developed mm-hmm. downtown. And the women's bookstore at that point was Kitty Corner. And I think that's when the bookstore ended. There wasn't quite the need to have this ghettoized.
But then In Other Words came, and they used to be on Hawthorne to
begin
with.
Yeah, that came a bit later.
Later,
and then
they're closing at the end of the month, which is interesting. And I don't think they're closing because there's not a need. I think they're closing because there's not a customer base.
Well, also independent bookstores are threatened all over the country.
Yes, they
so,
are.
Yeah.
I hope you're not buying from Amazon.
No,
just
in fact,
say.
I told Maureen earlier that I published a book a couple of years ago of essays that I wrote over the last 20 years, and I went to our local bookstore, Cloud and Leaf in Manzanita, and asked Jody for advice, and she said, "Here's what you do." And my first thing was, I'm not going to sell through Amazon. They treat their employees terribly. They're ripping the rug out from under independent bookstores.
And they're trying to control everything we do.
Everything in the world.
Yeah. I sent you that article, yes.
Yeah. I mean, when you find out that their management staff flips over every 2 years because they're so burned out, I figure, okay, even the managers are getting, you know.
There's a consortium of independent bookstores called ABE Books.
And
I think you all heard the speech that Ursula Le Guin gave
yes.
when she won the National Book Foundation. Ursula would not buy her books from Amazon. She bought from ABE.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think she sold her books through Amazon either. Though they might have.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Not when she had the choice.
Right.
When
yeah.
it was up to her. Yeah.
She was a voice we had on KBOO, and actually many times. I mean, I think that. I'm not sure, but I think the first time, actually, that she was on the station, I did an interview with her, with Barbara Lamonticello, who was actually my entree to Ursula. And then David Naiman took over the job of interviewing Ursula, and he's done a number of interviews with her. But I think she was somebody who really got KBOO. After I did the interview with her, which I remember was the afternoon of a total eclipse of the sun, February 26, 1979, memorable day. And it was an amazing interview. I mean, it just was so astonishing to actually get to talk to her. And then I was still the membership coordinator at KBOO, and next week she joined KBOO. She and her husband became KBOO members. So she was one of those people who I think really appreciated KBOO and appreciated, even though she had a larger audience than just KBOO listeners at that
mm-hmm.
point.
Yeah.
But she appreciated the time that she had on the station.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I remember doing a show. Was there a woman named Judy Bloom?
Jane Bloom. Jane Bloom was a public affairs director.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, so I put the women together, women in politics. So we had Margaret Strawn, Norma Paulus, one of the Roberts.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Roberts or Betty Roberts?
I can't. But there were four, and Jane did a wonderful interview with them, and we won the Jeanette Rankin Award for Women in Broadcasting that year.
Cool. Well, that was, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, one of my favorite KBOO images is this poster or this photograph taken outside the Belmont Street building. And I guess it was during a pledge drive. And Mildred Schwab, who was the city councilwoman for I don't know how many eons, and she's playing piano outside.
That is a brilliant photograph. She was wonderful. She was so supportive of KBOO. And this person, Dick, who I mentioned, is in that photograph. You can look and figure out who that
is. And we just had to figure out his last name, right?
Does KBOO still broadcast City Hall meetings?
No, we don't. Though, you know, it's I'm not exactly sure what we don't. It's partly, I think, they might be broadcast on cable.
They they are.
It was kind of contentious at the time. I remember there were a lot of us who thought it was really boring that we were broadcasting city council, and it took up a lot of time that could be devoted to other programming that was more creative. The reality of it is there's a lot of city council meetings that I've been at that I think really should be on KABU, because, and I wish that, you know, there was I understand a great meeting on Wednesday about the Occupy ICE camp and what the city's doing or not doing about it. So it's something to think about, actually, because, I mean, I think that KABU's had very good relationships with a lot of public officials. I used to have Sam Adams. I used to joke that Sam Adams was my co-host on Locus Focus because he was on a lot. I haven't developed the same relationship with any of the subsequent mayors, but that we've had a lot. There's a lot of city council people that I think have relationships with different programmers, and there is definitely a respect for KABU in city with city officials. In fact, when I changed my time for Locus Focus from 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning to 10:15 at first, and a couple of people that were connected to city stuff were like, thought about it and said, okay, there's no city meetings that time, because there was really concern that I was going to cut off access to some elected officials.
What I think about broadcasting the city council is that it allowed people who really wanted to testify about an issue to, like, okay, my agenda item is coming up in 15 minutes. If I split right now, I can get there and I can testify. And I think that that's one part. I think downtown is not the same as it would have been. Pioneer Courthouse Square wouldn't be there if KABU hadn't been broadcasting those pretty interesting meetings about the Cadillac Fairview project, which nobody remembers what it was going to be, but it was going to be about four blocks with sky bridges and a darkened street.
Seattle. It was going to be First Avenue on Seattle.
Anyway, Maureen was going to say something. I could tell I saw an eyebrow go up. What?
Well, you mentioned Mildred Schwab, and I don't know. It seemed to me that we got some money somehow from the city.
Donations. We did. Actually, we got money from the city for running city council, actually.
Yes.
We were paid, I mean,
right,
whatever it was.
And so I remember Mildred Schwab saying, well, Michael Wells is here with his tin cup.
Connie McCready.
Yeah, she came. She became mayor when Neil Goldschmidt was booted upstairs to the
she had she had some paintings done by some monkeys at the zoo, which she sold, and I think that money was donated to KABU.
I remember her coming in one time for an interview when I was the subscription coordinator, and I remember her walking around, and I think she was walking around in high heels and kind of stumbling around there, but she had this energy just kind of came in as his full force. And
I better be careful how I explain this thing, but I can tell you a little story that I recall from my days in the old KABU. Maggie Kuhn was the head of Gray Panthers. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And she was in town, and I had invited her to come and be interviewed. And she came with this lanky, skinny guy, and he was taking her around because he was very interested in the movement, and he tried to get involved in the interview, but I was not interested in having her chauffeur, you know, be in the interview. You know who I'm talking about.
Now state senator.
Now
state
he's become Senator Wyden.
Yeah.
Oh, that skinny little guy.
That's how he started.
Yeah, he started with Gray Panthers.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
He had a really high, squeaky voice then, too. It's interesting. I actually have I think my fondest memory of Ron Wyden was there were these two women, lesbians, who were killed in Medford in 1995. And there was an event that I guess it was a big memorial, and Ron Wyden was there. I interviewed him shortly afterwards, and he told me he just stood in the back of the memorial. Nobody knew he was there, and it was one time where I thought he was really very sensitive and not the politician that we often think of him. So it's helped me stay in touch. Every time I disagree with something he does, I still remember that image of him being at the back of that chapel.
I have a great image of him too. It turns out I bought a condominium in a building up by Washington Park, and he was my next door neighbor. And I remember I was leaving my condo one day, and down the hall was the laundry, and there's Ron Wyden. All he had on was a pair of pants, no shoes, no shirt, and he's carrying his laundry. back to his place to fold it, et cetera. I tell you, I thought, that's good.
Our senator does his own laundry.
Our senator's doing his own laundry.
Yeah. Well, I think it's time to take another little music break, and I don't know what Erin has queued up this time. Maybe she'll tell me. So we're going to listen to some music by Ferrin. I think it's Ain't Life a Brook. And this is Ferrin is a singer from Canada. And last I heard, she was living on Saturna Island. That's sort of in the Georgia Strait, south of Vancouver. And she was a favorite of us Women Soul Collective people.
Watch you reading a book. I get to thinking our love's a polished stone. You give me a long, drawn look. I know pretty soon you're gonna leave our home, and of course I mind. Especially when I'm thinking from my heart. But life don't clickety-clack down the street line track. It come together and it come apart. You say you hope I'm not the kind to make you feel obliged to go, taking through your time with a pain look in your eyes. You give me the furniture, we'll divide the photographs, go out to dinner one more time, have ourselves a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. When first you left, I stayed so sad I wouldn't sleep. I know that love's a gift, I thought yours was mine, and something that I could keep. Now I realize time is not the only compromise. A bird in the hand could be an all-night stand between a blazing fire and a pocket of skies. And so I hope I'm not the kind to make you feel obliged to go, digging through your time with a pain look in your eyes. I covered the furniture, I framed the photographs, went out to dinner one more time, had myself a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. Just the other day I got your letter in the mail. I'm happy for you, it's been so long. You've been wanting a cabin and a backwoods trail, and I think that's great. Me, I seem to find myself in school. It's all okay, I just wanna say I'm so relieved we didn't do it cruel. But ain't life a brook? Just when I get to feeling like a polished stone, I give me a long, drawn look. It's kind of a drag to find yourself alone, and sometimes a mind. Especially when I'm waiting on your heart. But life don't clickety-clack down a straight line track. It come together and it come apart. Cause I know you're not the kind to make me feel obliged to go, taking through my time with a pain look in my eyes. I sold the furniture, I put away photographs, went out to dinner one last time, had myself a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. But wasn't it fine?
And that was Ferrin doing Ain't Life a Brook. Maureen was suggesting, while we were listening to Ferrin, that it's time to name all the women who are on the KABU board that we can remember.
That we can remember.
So we've been just reminiscing about all the wonderful women who've come through KABU. But let's talk about, so let's start.
Okay, I'll start with Barbara Bernstein and Vicki Tempe were on the board.
Mm-hmm. And Maureen Key.
And Maureen Key. Tina Cunningham.
Right.
Carolyn McKnight.
Yes.
Ellen Wong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Vicki, over to you.
No.
Come on.
I'm no help to you.
Well, even though I disagreed with her, Phoebe Friedman, because she did some really good programming
She was one of my mentors, actually. Yeah. And she loved my dog, Wendy. Yeah. She always called her Wendela, so I like that, too. Celeste Carey, who came on a little bit later than
days.
And she's been on the, I don't think she's still on the board, but she was on the board for a long time and really held the ship steady through some very rocky storms. I'm trying to think of all the other people who were on the board while I was on the board. This is not a very good, we're not doing very well, guys.
No, we're not. And I think we're going back to an era, there have been a lot of women on the board since then.
Right.
And we're just going back to an era that is kind of in the distant past and not, I mean, I really honor all those people because they did such a great contribution. But I think there have been a lot of women ever since.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's the difference between the times that we're reminiscing about tonight and what has happened to KBOO since. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of women who come to the station now, as a lot of women who are growing up and don't can't imagine what it would be like to live in a world where abortions are illegal, or you can't get into engineering school, or you can't get a job doing a whole lot of different things, mm-hmm. that there was a time when KBOO was really pretty hostile to women. And despite Carol's wonderful experiences with some very gentle men who were there for a certain period in the mid to late 70s, I think even after you left, Carol, that there was still lots of hostility that had to be overcome.
Well, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, how sometimes the structure of something affects how things operate. And I think perhaps moving from that little basement 500 feet to downtown Bricks might, you know, we got to get more something or other, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm having another memory of being in that studio, and one of the times I liked the least when we were at on Yamhill Street was Rose Festival, because the Rose, they called it the Fun Center now. I'm not sure what they call it now. It's something much more politically acceptable, whatever. But it was basically a magnet for a lot of drunk sailors and a lot of other men acting out. And there was a fire escape that, if you were very crafty, you could get up the fire escape from Yamhill Street and get into the second floor at KBOO. And so it was very intimidating to be doing Women's Soul Friday night of Rose Festival week between 10 and 1 in the morning, and have these guys sometimes coming in, threatening like they're going to be coming in the window. And one time, Evan Slays, who was a very interesting guy, I mean, he had his issues, but I kind of really always enjoyed him. And he was at the station. He seemed to like to hang out during Women's Soul. And he was there when this woman was screaming down on Yamhill Street, and there was something going on, and Evan ran down, actually, and I think kind of broke it up. But that was another issue about where KBOO was when it was downtown. Mm-hmm. It was not, especially during Rose Festival, it was not a very savory place to be. And then, of course, when we moved here, and I mentioned earlier about the prostitutes and the pimps, but there was basically what's now the Jupiter Hotel was it was a drug house and a house of prostitution, basically. And I was doing a show that ran from 11 to midnight every week. And when I come in, I mean, we were given keys. Those of us who were late night programmers were given keys to the door because you didn't want to wait to be buzzed in. You just needed to get in. And I remember a couple of times coming into the station. In those days, you could park right in front of the station, which was one advantage. But there'd be like pimps on either corner yelling at each other and women in the middle of it. And it was just really frightening. So when the Jupiter Hotel took over the premises, it was a great relief. I think that the whole situation got cleaned up, and actually they moved all to Sandy Boulevard. And I heard things about city council about neighbors complaining about the same scene happening there. Mm-hmm. But those are kind of the changes that we've been through over the last 40 years.
Well, I think you're right. Wherever you put the station, it's going to be trending up.
Well, it certainly is. So, because, I mean, it's pretty clear that Portland is aiming to have a west downtown and an east downtown, mm-hmm. and little by little we're seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, it's a whole other show. But I think that watching this neighborhood transform itself, there was a certain point where, oh, wow, there's places to eat around here. And the best coffee in Portland's just a few blocks away. And there's, you know, some really great things in the neighborhood. And the neighborhood is still kind of cool.
It's funky.
They did take out the farm. I was really sorry when that restaurant left. But it's got this funky edge. And I'm so worried about Portland losing that. And I wonder what role KBOO can play in holding on to the Keep Portland Weird mantra.
it's going to be tough because we're in a very capitalistic society where if you can make a buck by jacking up the rent, you will. I've even had that discussion within my extended family where somebody has a fairly nice house on a pretty big lot, small house, big lot, Northeast Portland, and now is working in LA and is going to rent out the house. And I had another set of friends who are in their mid-30s who live in Portland and would enjoy having such a house. And so when I asked the extended family member, you know, here is what this couple can afford, $1,800 a month, and I know what the mortgage is on this house. Oh, well, that's not enough.
He probably bought the house, what, in the 80s when it was
on? No, it was purchased in 1998.
My property values are still a lot lower than they are now.
Not 98, pardon me, 2009.
Oh, okay.
For like 180.
Yeah.
And I know what the mortgage is. So I just think what's going on is that we have been beset by a culture that says the more money you have, the better. And it's driving, I'll tell you, the coast, housing is impossible.
It's all over Oregon. But I want to go back to something related to Kibu. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really appreciate you for every day, Vicki, is that you had the vision, probably with some other people, to buy this building that we're in as opposed to just continuing to rent.
We had a lease option. And Harriet Baskus.
Harriet.
Right.
So I was the manager, then Bridget Dennis was the manager, and then Harriet Baskus was the manager, and Harriet... We had this lease, 5-year lease option, and Harriet was able to negotiate a big loan from the Jackson Foundation at zero interest with the same amount of payment, in other words, just as if we were paying rent, and use the loan to pay off and own the building, get the option, pay for the option. And so Harriet had that kind of foresight. And she's another person that would be great interviewed.
We should have her... down from Seattle.
You'll have to get all these other characters to come in. Get Harriet, get Bridget if she's willing to
actually,
come in.
We wanted Bridget, but Bridget doesn't stay up late at night anymore, so she couldn't do it.
But, you know, there's Monica. You know, you could have another whole three different people from, as the station move forward, three other women who have made a really big difference.
Well, Harriet made a really big difference in my life because she really got me into being a documentary producer.
Uh-huh.
Sort of wanted to be... I used to listen to radio documentaries when I was in high school on this rock station, WBZ in Boston, and they would play documentaries like at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And I was really intrigued by the whole idea of radio documentaries. So I got to know Harriet, and I was doing some audio production, but I was pretty much doing music. And she got me involved with a radio documentary she was going to produce, and actually two of them. And I learned an awful lot from working with her. Mm-hmm. Basically, I learned structure, how to create structure, because otherwise everything would have been woo. And I appreciate that. I feel like she got me going on my lifetime career.
Some other thing to say about Harriet. So when this station that we're sitting in was being built, the KBOO Foundation had received permission from the FCC to put a new station on the air in Astoria. And a group of us, in fact, I think Harriet and Michael O'Rourke, I think it was Dave Kies and I, drove down to Astoria to meet with this group of people who were the Astoria people who wanted to have this station and, you know, was kind of creeping toward it. And we went, oh, wait a minute. These people want their own community radio station. They have no one who knows anything about radio. And Harriet was in the car. So on the way back to Portland in a rainstorm, of course, we kind of turned to Harriet and said, are you willing to move to Astoria? And Kay Bridge, rest in peace, and I wrote a grant to CPB for a women's training grant. we had 3 days before the deadline and got a grant that would pay half of Harriet's salary to run the Astoria station. So she did everything. She did the community feasibility survey. She worked with the Coast Guard. She worked with one of the most notorious logging companies on the North Coast to get the spar to put the transmitter on a peak, Megler Mountain, across the river from Astoria. Did all the fundraising, found out what the community wanted, trained everybody about how to use the equipment. So she was doing that, and I probably would have lost my mind if she hadn't, because we were doing this, and she was doing that.
Because this, well, actually, the station was built at this point, wasn't
no.
it?
No.
Oh, it's still being built?
No.
Okay.
Because KMUN went on the air in 1983.
Okay, that's when we moved in 82. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, I remember, I think the expectation was that KMUN, which is the Astoria mm-hmm. station, which they now call
KMUN.
No, it's North Coast Radio. Coast Community Radio.
Yeah.
I got.
They have about three repeaters.
Yeah. And they were. We expected that they were just going to be repeating KABU the same way that KABU started out repeating CRAB mm-hmm. in Seattle. But they were just rearing to go. And they not only yeah. got on the air, they never were a repeater. They just got on the air right. producing their own right. stuff. They had stereo broadcast long before KABU did.
And because their serving was considered an area with an unmet need, they got a lot more money from Corporation for Public Broadcasting than we do because... there wasn't, when KMUN started, OPB didn't have a signal down there. We certainly didn't. That was it, you know. They've been a really vital, as another community or you know community radio station, they've been vital during huge storm events. They've been the only link. There's been times when all the cell phone towers went down, the 911 towers went down, but KMUN was able to broadcast and tell people what was happening and where emergency services were. I mean, they've been a critical element in and safety in that part of the coast.
Even though, I mean, Oregon Public Broadcasting now has repeaters all mm-hmm. up and down the coast, but I think that, and it was a real concern at KMUN because they were trying to keep OPB out, and one of the ways they did it was to air, become an NPR station and air All Things Considered, which was kind of a criteria for being a reputable station. It didn't keep OPB out, interestingly enough, but I know that the people I know in Astoria listen to KMUN. Mm-hmm. And there's a real loyalty. And I love that station. It's one of my favorite stations. And they have great programming. And they've got a lot of local programming.
And no politics.
They've got some politics.
Listen, I'm in their air shed. I know what they
But I'm thinking, it's like Carol Newman, who does this wonderful yes. folk show. And I have the tape. I included it in my last documentary about the fossil fuel implosion in the mm-hmm. Northwest. And I have this tape of Carol Newman finding out that Oregon LNG had pulled the plug.
Yeah.
And she announces it over the air in the middle of her music show, and mm-hmm. she's crying. And it's just this powerful... Mm-hmm. And that was politics.
But they don't do any... They've never broadcast the Port of Astoria, which has huge impact on the economy of northwestern Oregon. They don't cover any of the city council meetings. They have stayed really hands-off of talking about issues about racism, about what's going on with ICE, which has a huge impact in Southwest Washington. The oyster growers, the cranberry growers are dependent, and all the tourism industry, heavily mm-hmm. dependent on Hispanic workers. And when you are threatened with being raided all the time, I mean, it creates a really huge amounts of anxiety for Hispanic families in that part of the state.
Well, actually,
maybe if OPB covers it and there's an NPR feed, they'll broadcast. Well, I'm sorry, but
I've broached with Carol the possibility of them broadcasting Locus Focus.
Oh,
so I'm going to work
good.
On that
because
there was a guy that was wanting to talk to me a couple of years ago who was a programmer on KMUN, and he was concerned about how to bring politics to the station, and he wanted to know how I got away with it. And I guess he talked to Carol, and she said, "Well, KABU is a whole different." Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the things that we can get away with it because of the community that we're in, because we are a bigger entity, and because we have... But we were... I mean, back when I started coming to KABU, KABU was not very political.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, it started out as a classical music station, and then it was the music station where you played music nobody else would play, and the idea of public affairs was really...
Obscure.
So, I mean, when I saw Karen Burdick at the Weezer Fiddle Festival recording stuff, even that was like a real big step of having somebody mm-hmm. out there doing... kind of this cultural programming.
So there are institutions in all our communities that deserve scrutiny.
Yes,
put it that
yes.
way.
You better get on the board over there.
Yeah, it's an hour drive one way to get there.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's even harder in the winter, but...
Well, it's just, you know...
Can't you phone in? Well, actually, I want to take another music break.
Sure.
If I can get Aaron's attention. Let's see. Hello, Miss Engineer. we have to knock on the window.
Erin is being her usual.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to play some music. Okay. So what do we have up now? Oh, great. We're going to do Smile by Laura Nyro.
Okay.
Old-time women Kebu people who are reminiscing about the past, and maybe at the end we'll reminisce a little bit about the future. But I'm here with Maureen Key, who was early board president in the late 70s, early 80s. Carol Mazur, who was program director, but I learned tonight also before that, the development director back in the mid-70s. And Vicky Stapiello, under the name of Vicky Tempe, who was board president when Maureen was the vice president of the board and then became station manager in, mm-hmm. I think, 1980? I think something like that.
Yep, December 1980.
Okay. And I'm Barbara Bernstein, and I've been at KBOO kind of nonstop since 1978, a little smattering earlier.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you station manager?
During the building phase of getting this, the studios were in built, I think I left in July of 83. So that was about 3 years. And then in 2004, I was the manager when Denise Kowalczyk had her child, and I got recruited to hold down the fort, so to speak, while she went through 6 months of having her child and maternity leave. And then in 2013-14, that winter of October.
That winter of much discontent.
Yes, wasn't it? Yeah, it was really interesting. There was a time when Michael Wells and I were walking to lunch together during that period in late 2013, and he turned to me and he says, "Well, do you think we're going to make it?" And I said, "I really can't tell." And I was serious because there was such miscommunication within the organization. I think the staff did not particularly have a problem. It was going on within the board and the volunteer community, and there was so much misinformation, which almost always leads to conflict. And I kind of shoehorned myself in because they were without a manager. They'd had a manager that the board had promoted up who had a very thin resume. She had been hired to do some kind of development work. And then when you look back at her history, you found out she was 1 year here, 1 year there, 1 year. And she proposed doing a major change to the personnel policy, making KBOO an at-will employer as opposed to for cause. And for those of you who are not steeped in all that junk, at-will means, I don't like the color of your shirt today, you're fired. And one of the board members leaked this new personnel policy out to the broader community. And the board, and I always blame the board for anything. I don't care about the board who's sitting now, but the people at the very top, if they don't set a standard for due diligence and ethics, you cannot expect that from anyone in the organization. So the board didn't read this policy. They just signed off on it. And it was hefty. But the staff found out, and they formed a union. And the day that I showed up to be their relief temporary manager was the day that they were voting on joining the union. And funny story, the rep from the International Communications Union, the shop steward, I guess you would say, was here, and she had the ballot box for the staff members to vote. And she and I shook hands, and I said, oh, by the way, do you know Lee Shore? Oh, yeah, I go way back with Lee. Well, Lee was a friend of mine at the Coast who was a labor organizer, came up through the garment district in New Jersey and went all over the United States and the world working with displaced workers. So I could feel some of the staff people who already knew me, but they were just kind of like leaning back. Well, this is interesting. We just have a temporary manager who's kind of linked up with this, with the union. But the union, I think, was a really good move in a variety of ways. It created such clarity about who is responsible for what and what is the process. Workers are protected, but so is the organization. When you have your working paper, you know, your rules of how we're going to work together really spelled out, I thought it was an excellent move.
Comes a long way from the first personnel policy, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure, though. I haven't really. So this is a union station?
This is a union shop.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's been now for, what, 4 years?
Mm. Yeah, it started in, well, yeah, October of 2013.
Yeah, almost 5 years.
Well,
yeah.
You know, that was an interesting time because so many of us who hadn't really been involved in KBOO for many years came out of the woodwork mm-hmm. to support what we all felt could be the loss of the station that we all had worked very mm-hmm. hard to build.
Mm-hmm. But it was actually really complicated, too. I had conversations with that station manager, and actually some of the criticism she had of the station, I totally shared, and of some of the staff, but the process that she was going to go through was something, no, you don't do it that way. You're not king. You're not the dictator.
You're not queen.
Yeah, whatever. And it
and you don't do three staff positions at the same time.
No, yeah. That's right. She had some strange title.
Yeah.
Chief Navigator or something like that. So I think, I mean, that period reminded me of the period we were talking about mm-hmm. before Michael Wells became mm-hmm. station manager,
right.
Back when you
exactly.
were just getting on the board.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's been several, then there were a couple other periods, I think, there were periods in the mid-90s that were also kind of shaky.
Yeah.
And I think it's often been dissension within the board, and then it's been sometimes struggles between the board and the staff. And if you look at other stations, particularly Pacifica stations, they have replicable problems like this, only theirs are so much worse than ours.
Yeah.
I don't think the staff has ever locked the board out or vice versa, like has happened at Pacifica Station.
What happened in 2013-14, so I got in the position of taking care of business, I said that my first job is to help people calm down, because we cannot think well or make decisions when we're all so riled up. So that's the first thing, try to calm people. Second, let's find out what our real financial condition is, because the claim was that we were going to go bankrupt. And it turned out that nobody was looking at the endowment. Nobody was looking at the 3 months of operating reserve that the station still had maintained. We could have had not a dime come in for 3 months and continue to operate. And then kind of just getting that word out, that made a big difference. And so we got a and Michael Wells, rest in peace, and very peacefully, was a terrific treasurer. And he really, you know, got the system set up in place so we would know our financial. But people were arguing about a financial condition that they didn't really know what it was. Well, just get the information, you know, let's look at the facts.
Well, I remember there was this meeting at Tabor Space, and it kind of reminds me of a meeting I didn't go to at Mountain Moving Cafe in 1977, I guess.
I was there.
Yes, I've heard stories. I mean, people who never walked into...
We stood up and sang, "We shall not be moved."
Right. But this meeting at Tabor Space was... We were supposed to be meeting inside, and there was some conflicting interest. So we wind up meeting outside on the grass. And people were talking about sort of like KBOO's financial history, and this woman who was on the board, and I don't know what her role was, but she was an officer on the board, and she was talking about our CPB grant, and it was like new to her. She didn't know that we'd ever had one before.
And she was the treasurer.
Right, exactly. So I stood up and I said, no, actually KBOO's been getting CPB grants since they were HEW grants. I mean, we've been getting them since the 70s. And and I talked about how we lost our CPB grant, which was really shouldn't have happened, and why it was so important to get it back. And I got the sense, really, that the board is really without any institutional history at all, and it was rather disturbing. So I think that's another thing that's really important. That's why we old-timers have to stick around and help people know what the institutional history is.
Yep. Well, it's a really good job has been done of the interviews and all that sort of thing, celebrating the 50 years. I think that's a good start.
So how does it feel, Maureen, to be back here after how many years of absence? Huh.
Well, how does it feel? All this equipment. And it's messy.
Like it's always been?
Just like it's always been.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's part of our institutional culture.
And it feels, people are very friendly, I would say. So it feels pretty good.
Mm-hmm. I notice, I mean, to me, one of the biggest differences is that there's a lot more diversity. You see a lot of different faces.
Mm-hmm. And younger people coming in.
But we were young then.
Well, that's true. But I'm talking about really young people, like teenagers. And,
oh, really? Good.
And Bridget was a teenager. Bridget Robbie was a teenager when she was
that's
working.
That's true, but she was the only one.
And Morgan also. They were the two teenagers.
How about Clay Abraham Gordon?
I was thinking of Clay Gordon.
Yeah, he was 19 back then.
He was
I have a coffee cup that he designed for the station.
And I do remember when we talked about how we really had to not just wait till somebody came, but make overtures to the Black community in Portland, because George Page couldn't do it for everybody. And I recall voting on, you know, getting some younger kids in to do music shows. And I didn't like a lot of that music at that particular point. It wasn't hip-hop yet. But I felt very strongly that we had to go out and find ways to bring younger Black people into the
radio station. Well, at the time, we created the first Black popular music strip in the city. There was no other place in Portland where you could hear any Black music.
That's correct.
And I liked some of it I didn't like.
But it wasn't a question
wasn't
of our
me.
Personal
exactly.
feelings
I felt,
about
because I was one of the people who really advocated for the Black programming strip.
Right. Who was it? Was it J.R.?
Oh, J.W. Friday.
Friday.
Yeah, he was.
He was very popular.
Yeah,
well,
he did Saturday Night Show, and it was one of the most popular shows. I mean, Saturday was basically a lot of Black programming. Mm-hmm. We had George Page, and then Tom went and alternated with somebody else doing blues. It was the white blues guys, and then J.W. Friday was on like all Saturday night, and that had also was fraught with some problems later on down the line. But it was certainly an eye opener that KBOO could really fill a niche. So then we started having Black programming from 5 to 7. It basically took out the classical music.
And Sheila did. I think Sheila was engineered that.
Yeah.
And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
Sheila Rubin, who was a program director in the early 80s.
Yeah. One of the things I'm going to bring up, because you just said something about friendly, people being friendly. When I was working in Yamhill Street, I had to teach myself, train myself, because I'm much more outgoing now than I was when I started out. It's partly having somebody who really loves you, who tells you you're great every day, you know, and that's what we all need. But so I had to, at the station, I noticed how often a new person would come in and no one would give eye contact. No one would say hello. Even during a pledge drive, people, we used to have the pledge tables out front at Yamhill Street. And so I told myself that to learn to get over my own reticence and to welcome people, say hello, introduce myself. And that's something that has changed at KBOO. And when somebody said to me, some talking about all of this history, I said, what I remember wasn't so much that people are stuck in their particular racial or gender category, but that they were such intellectuals. They didn't think about saying hello to a stranger because they were so into their own thing.
There was a little arrogance around.
Yes, well, I remember when Alan Bailey was hired to be station manager, and there was a photograph of him in the lobby, and he says, this is our new station manager, Alan Bailey. Be nice to him.
Yeah. That's good.
And I think that has gradually changed over the years, and some of it is Monica's recent work, but I ran for the board, I don't know how long ago it was, and I showed up to be interviewed on the air. Nobody who was around knew me except Ani, and I had not seen Ani since she was like 16 years old, and she remembered who I was because she and I had worked together downtown. And I'm like, this is a bearded lady, you know? And I kind of had this internal reaction, but she was so warm. She was so personable, and it was only years later that we realized that we had had an old history. But I melted because of that interpersonal human warmth that came from her.
Mm-hmm. And that's why she's been volunteer coordinator for so long.
Yeah, probably.
It's true. Yeah. When I had been gone for 14 years, and I came back to the station for various things, and Ani was really there and really warm, as if I had known her all those years before, and
right.
I hadn't.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, speaking of Ani, in just a few minutes, Ani Haynes and Aaron Yonke, who's our engineer now, are going to be coming. I think they're going to actually do it from the other room, but they're going to be talking about the women at the station since all of us stopped being young.
Us old ladies.
So it's going to be the younger perspective.
All right.
And,
good.
So I think it's going to be interesting to carry on that conversation. But I want to thank you guys. It's really been great to convene you all for
all right,
this
thank
walk
you.
Through memory lane. And yeah. We've been hearing from Vicky Stapiella, who was station manager back
and
in
the And now
there.
I'm Victoria. You know why?
Oh,
I'm in a small town with five Vickies. You're in the grocery store.
Victoria.
Somebody says Vicky, and it's like five of us.
Okay,
show
Victoria
up.
Stapiella, who used to be Vicky Tempe. Carol Mazur, who was around in the 70s and has been in and out of the station since
and
then.
And still Carol Mazur.
And still Carol Mazur, right. And she was a program director back. Were you the first woman program director?
No, Karen was.
Oh, Karen, that's right. Okay.
Karen was.
Second woman program
Second.
Director. And then Maureen Key, who was my mentor and had a fundraise back in the early 80s. And she was a board president back starting, I think, around 1980 when Vicky, who was the board president until she became station manager, and then Maureen moved up a notch. And
luckily.
Yes, fortunately. And so this is just kind of our own very personalized, idiosyncratic mm-hmm. history of women's role at KBOO from 1971 mm-hmm. until probably the early
83.
80s. Yeah, 83, I think.
And I would say it was a good thing we were here.
Yeah. I think that's my reason why I chose you all is I think that you are all groundbreakers. And I think that mm-hmm. KBOO is the way it is today because of you guys. So
thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it.
You know, it is true. You know, I remember Karen, and I don't remember if it was 76 or 77, but it didn't get put in that way at the most recent Historical Society exhibit. When Karen said to me, let's do 24 hours of women's program for International Women's Day, that's when it started. Yeah. That's when it started. And we managed to do that.
Actually, when I came on, I was doing International Women's Day. I did it for a number of years. Yeah. And it was at that point. We got up to 48 hours, I think, at one point. We were really gung-ho.
And, you know, even today when I, you know, hear this, it's kind of like, oh, my God, I was there, you know, at mm-hmm. the first building block.
Right.
And also when you think of how KBOO does serve this community.
Mm-hmm.
It's not perfect, and it always has these big burps when weird things will happen. But, you know, 50 years is
a long time.
Kanahara.
Yes.
You
know? The oldest in the country, I heard.
Yes,
somewhere.
Not quite. Yeah, except for the oldest independent. So we actually are out of time. We got to play one more tune, and then it's going to be Ani and Aaron's time to move us into the more recent decades. But Maureen and Carol and Vicki, it's been great talking with you. Thanks a whole
lot. Thank you, Barbara, for doing this.
And thanks, Aaron, for engineering. And who are we going out with now? And this is Alice Stewart, Statesboro Blues. So this is somebody else we played a lot in Woman's Soul back in the late 70s.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. I just met a man.